You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Russia limits the number of flights Finnair is allowed to operate over its airspace. Experts warn this could be the first step in a much bigger fight over EU carbon tariffs.
This appears to be the first evidence that Russia is willing to follow through on its threats over its opposition to the implementation of the European Emissions Trading Scheme on its airlines.
Also coming up in the next hour is the honeymoon over for Mario Monti. And in the second half hour of today's programme, we'll be talking leisure, including ladies in bikinis who brandish machine guns. Who says there's not something for everyone here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But first, let's catch up on the latest global headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Fierce gunfights between security forces and rebels have broken out on the streets of the Syrian capital Damascus. Residents of the Medse neighborhood said they were hiding in their homes as gunfire occurred outside. Anti-Assad activists have uploaded photographs of gunmen in armored vehicles rolling down the streets of the capital's Kafr Susay district, pointing long rifles over the top. Others have posted a video said to be from Medze showing black clouds of smoke rising from between concrete buildings as the sound of gunfire rattled in the background. They said Free Syrian Army rebels were attacking a security force barracks in the district, and security forces had sent in busloads of plainclothes militiamen to help them in the fight against the rebels. In other developments, UN Special Envoy Kofi Annan told reporters at the US State Department that he would be looking for new ways of putting pressure on Damascus.
Some say the plan is maybe dead. Is the problem the plan or the problem is implementation? If it's implementation, how do we get action on that? And if it is a plan, what other options do we have? So all these questions are now being discussed, and we are also exploring how we can work with other governments in the region and around the world to achieve our goals.
UN monitors have entered the Syrian hamlet of Mazrat al-Kubair, where up to 78 people were reported killed in cold blood 2 days earlier, and an eyewitness described a scene of shredded and burned flesh, making clear a terrible crime had occurred. President Obama says European leaders must make difficult decisions to steer the Eurozone away from crisis. Speaking at the White House, Mr. Obama said the US would support Europe in implementing the hard solutions that were needed to solve the ongoing debt crisis. He said a deep new recession in Europe would have an impact on the US economy. Meanwhile, reports that Spain will ask for help for its banks this weekend have been played down by authorities across the Eurozone. There were also reports that the Eurogroup of finance ministers would meet on Saturday to discuss the issue. Representatives of the Spanish government and European authorities said they had no knowledge of such plans. Spain has said all week that no action would be taken until it knows how much money its banks need. The UN nuclear watchdog says no progress has been made in talks with Iran on easing an investigation into the country's suspected nuclear weapons research. Hermann Nakertz, global head of inspections for the International Atomic Energy Agency, said after Friday's meeting in Vienna that no date for further talks on the matter had been set. The United States, European powers and Israel want to curb Iranian atomic activities they suspect are intended to produce nuclear bombs. Tehran says the aims of its nuclear program are purely civilian. New Zealand's Prime Minister John Kaye has said his country has no concerns about the expansion of China through the Pacific region. Speaking at a meeting with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Mr. Kaye said he was ensuring an open dialogue with China to make sure that its expansion was appropriate.
No, we're not fearful of the emergence of China as a much more significant force in the region. We think it's inevitable that they will become a larger and more significant economic power as they industrialise and urbanise. We are actively involved with the Chinese in trying to ensure that what role they play in the Pacific from an aid perspective or others is directed in the right place.
And the Duke of Cambridge and Prince Harry have visited their grandfather, the Duke of Edinburgh, in hospital. Clarence House said the princes had paid a short private visit to Prince Philip. He was admitted to hospital in London with a bladder infection on Monday and could not join the Queen at the final Diamond Jubilee events. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. And James will be back in a little under 25 minutes with a full roundup of today's headlines. The time is 5 minutes past the top of the hour and you're listening to Midori House. And our top story today focuses on the issue of aviation. Finnair's been told it can't operate as many flights over Siberia as it would like to this summer. This, of course, is grim news for the airline, which is trying to expand its long-haul service to Asia. But the Finns, it appears, are the unlucky first recipients of a more far-reaching campaign by Moscow. The Russians are believed to have refused Finnair's request in retaliation at the European tariff system designed to cut airline emissions. It's a move that worried aviation experts such as Charles Olcock, the editor of Aviation International. When I spoke to Charles earlier on today, I began by asking him what this move could mean for European aviation.
It's hugely significant, Emma, because this appears to be the first evidence that Russia is willing to follow through on its threats over its opposition to the implementation of the European Emissions Trading Scheme on its airlines. And essentially, what we now see are the gloves coming off. Apparently, the Russian government has said, fine, if you're going to charge our airlines for emissions, we'll show you how we respond to that. We're going to start messing around and denying you traffic rights. And unfortunately, the Finns just seem to be the first EU airline to have applied for rights since this row blew up.
Finnair has received fewer summer rights to fly over Siberia, as you say. How is this going to affect their schedule and their markets, considering that they're trying to expand their long-haul business to Asia to try and make up for the losses in Europe?
Yeah, it will make it very awkward, because the fact is, if you're going to start new services, you have to have sufficient frequency of flights for it to be commercially attractive. Now, if they, you know, I'm told they're only getting half of what they asked for, well, that means half of the number of services that they're going to operate, which will probably make them less commercially viable. I think Russia's been quite deliberate here. It could have probably said, you're not getting any, go away. But I think it's testing the water. It's saying, okay, let's just do a slight slap on the wrist, see how that goes down, and then, you know, do more if we feel we have to.
Russia already charges over flight fees to airlines such as SAS, and they've already said that they pay, what, $14 million a year for this right to fly over to Siberia, and this is going to be unsustainable for them financially.
Yes, that's right. Well, Russia for some time, even before this emissions trading row, has charged for overflight rights. It's one of a small but not insignificant groups of states that also include China that do this. In my view, it's kind of a throwback to the communist years, you could say. And, you know, they argue, well, we've got this huge airspace. We have to provide a lot of air traffic control. It's all very complicated. There's costs there. But the fact is, you know, Russia wants it both ways in a way. It wants to be part of the West. It wants to join the WTO, wants to sort of participate in the benefits of free trade. And yet at the same time, it's saying, oh, no, you know, we're a special case. We're going to charge for these things. But, you know, that's a long-running issue. The more immediate and far more worrying issue is the way Russia is now using this stick to punish the EU.
Do you think that, were you expecting this to happen?
I was, but I was nonetheless surprised when I heard about this today. I was waiting for, you know, as they say, the other shoe to drop. I was waiting for Russia or perhaps China or perhaps India to really take direct action. And I guess it had to happen, and, well, now it has happened. Now what I'm going to have to do is watch this very closely, because I don't think this is the end of it. I think we're going to see more episodes like this, and unfortunately it fulfills my prediction that, you know, we could be heading for a trade war here.
If you think you're going to head for a trade war, how do we get around this? Because the EU are a little bit stuck. Legislation has already been passed, obviously, to implement this trading scheme. It can't legally back down, can it? It has to impose these, and it can't let Russia get away with not having to pay when everybody else has to pay.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. You see, the truth is the EU knows very well that it has upset major powers like the US and Russia and China over this imposition of ETS on foreign airlines. But the problem is it's passed legislation, as you say. And it's passed this legislation in order to meet its very solemn obligations under the Kyoto Agreement. And so even though it now realizes it's in a political bind, the EU can't just say, oh, well, forget about it, you know, you don't have to do it. Because then the European Union airlines would say, well, hold on a second, we're having to do the emissions trading scheme, that's costing us money, and now you're saying that the foreign airlines don't have to do it and can come and go as they please. That's anti-competitive. So you could actually start a second front in the trade war in that respect.
You mentioned earlier on that the Chinese and the Indians are among the countries who've been angered by the ETS. Am I right in thinking that the Chinese have delayed the purchase of some planes from Airbus as a result of this?
Yes, we have heard essentially confirmation of this now, that the Chinese government has essentially prevented a state-backed carrier in Hong Kong from ordering some Airbuses that it was certainly planning to do. I know full well behind the scenes that Airbus and their parent group, EADS, are desperately talking to the European officials and saying, for heaven's sake, you know, look what you're doing to our business here. But again, you know, the Europeans are in a real bind here. They're kind of backed against the wall. They are saying, not without reason, look, the rest of the world needs to fulfill its environmental obligations. It's said repeatedly that if other states, including Russia and China, would have their own emissions trading scheme, then Europe would not impose its scheme on those countries. But you know, this applies to America too. These countries are just saying, forget about it. You do what you like, but we're not doing it.
When you mentioned a little earlier on about Russia's joining the World Trade Organization when it joined in December, hadn't it agreed in principle that all new overflight fees should be free of charge, basically? So, in effect, isn't Russia breaching its free trade commitments?
That's true, and I bet the lawyers are looking at that right now. I mean, yes, my understanding is, and I'm not a legal expert in this regard, but if you join the WTO, you're roughly speaking, you're signing up to the Western Club, and you're saying, okay, we're going to honor the reciprocal rights that other Western countries give each other, where they basically say, yes, you can overfly our territory without charge and without undue hindrance. And so, you know, this is what I'm saying. Russia's sort of playing fast and loose here. In order to fight its battle over emissions trading, it appears to be compromising its very young membership of the WTO. And I wouldn't be surprised if lawyers acting for EU airlines are now going through the WTO rule book, and they might say, okay, maybe we need to challenge Russia's membership of the WTO on this basis.
And what about the political element? You've talked about a trade war. You mentioned there that the airliners are looking at the legal rule book. What can politicians do?
Well, I think one thing that they might try and do, and it may be their only get out, is to essentially try and kick the ball off into the long grass, meaning that a possible resolution has always been that you could broker an agreement through what's called the International Civil Aviation Organization. That's a UN body. And in theory, politicians in Europe could say, okay, ICAO, please get us out of this mess, come up with some sort of worldwide agreement that would just about please everybody. The problem with that is ICAO has been talking about that for most of my professional lifetime. And frankly, ICAO are a bunch of chronic procrastinators who never actually resolve anything at all. And I think the Europeans, who are at least sincere about the environmental case, would say, hey, we're not having that, because those clowns at ICAO will just talk about this for another 10 years and do nothing.
Charles Alcock from Aviation International, as ever, it's a pleasure having you on. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us, because in a little while we'll be asking if the honeymoon with Mario Monti is truly over in Italy.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
On the 16th and 17th of June, please join us at Midori House, the London headquarters of Monocle, as we break out the bunting for the very first Monocle Country Fair, our unique global take on a gloriously English tradition. complete with market stalls hosted by some of our favourite nations and shopkeepers. We'll have face painting for children, marvellous musical performances, a guest chef in the kitchen, and much more. The Monocle Country Fair will be running from 11 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon on the 16th and 17th of June at Midori House, 1 Dorset Street, in the heart of London's Marylebone. For more information, head to monocle.com/countryfair, and that's fair with a Y, of course.
Welcome back. When Mario Monti took over at the helm in Italy last year, there were cheers all round from those who were simply glad that he wasn't Silvio Berlusconi. Other EU member states fighting to save the euro were also glad that it seemed a cool-headed technocrat was now in charge of a basket case of an economy. But is the honeymoon over? At a speech to bankers on Thursday, the Italian Prime Minister admitted his government had lost the support of Italy's so-called big powers. To explain this and to talk about Monti's position, we're now joined by the journalist Gianni Riotta, former editor-in-chief of Il Sole. A very warm welcome to the to Midori House, Gianni. Tell us more about this speech to bankers when Signor Monte said that the government had lost the support of the Italian big powers. What did he mean by that?
That's difficult to say, because if you think of a single person that in Italy embodies the so-called strong powers, the poteri forti, is Professor Monti. I don't want to give to your listeners the list of his achievements and the organizations that he's a member of, but clearly he's a member of the establishment. So I think he's sending a signal that he feels lonely. He's saying the political class, the parties, always supported me with a grudge. And now even the establishment supports me with a grudge. And so he means I'm weak, help me.
You say that he's weak, he's lonely, he's asking for help. What about those around him in his government? Are they supporting him, or are they too scared to take on the big powers as well?
The problem was that Mr. Monti didn't have any political base when he stepped into office at the end of 2011. He simply was a man that the European Union and the world of finance would trust better than Berlusconi to rescue Italy from the brink. And he did. How did he do that? He did it raising taxes on people that already pay taxes, lengthening the age to pension to people that are like workers or clerks. And so the usual suspects paid for Italy's stability. And they are angry now because they don't see the government promoting growth, and they don't see the government chasing the tax dodgers, the tax cheaters, with the energy that we were hoping that they would.
Are we seeing, therefore, another European leader facing the block simply because he was implementing an austerity policy?
That was the idea. The idea was, let's do the bad cop. Let Mr. Monti play the bad cop, because he's a senator for life already, so he doesn't need to be re-elected. And then once he has done the cleaning job, the politicians will step again. But the problem is that the cleaning job is proving too painful, and the politicians are restless, and the populist list, the link to the former comedian Beppe Grillo, the so-called Five Stars movement, won elections in big cities like Parma, for example, and the polls credit them with 20-30% at the national political election next year. So we are risking to have one third of the Congress, the House and the Senate, by a movement that proposed Italy leaving the euro and going back to the liras, and stopping any kind of technology in the country, research. It's a nasty moment.
You're talking about a cleaning job. He's calling them taboo-breaking reforms, and that labour groups such as Confindustria aren't really understanding truly what he's on about. Is that a good enough justification for his work?
Let me be straight. I support President Monti, and I think that President Monti is delivering a dose of reality in Italy. But where he's wrong is that he doesn't do it with fast enough. He's like, you know, giving the bitter medicine drop by drop, and then if the union gets mad, he relents, and then if the companies get mad, he relents. Instead, he should say to the Italian people, like, look, this is it, fair and square, and if you don't like it, I'm ready to go home. And since the Italian people are responsible, once he says, I'm ready to go home, they will say, no, stay, please. And he will see the bluff of the unions, and he will see the bluff of Confindustria and the companies. But if he tries to make everybody happy, he loses it.
What about the support of the media? Because what appears to have happened is that they too have turned against Monti. I think the Corriere della Sera has come out against him. You yourself, a former editor of Il Sole, how would you portray Monti at the moment?
I'm also the former editor of Corriere della Sera, and Mario Monti was our most important columnist at Corriere della Sera. So he, as a former columnist, sees himself criticized by his former newspaper. And I understand that this is like irks him a lot. The way he responded to that was wrong. And he was wrong for Monti, and he was wrong for Corriere della Sera, because Monti named the main business commentator of Corriere della Sera, Professor Francesco Giavazzi. Monti nominated him a consultant on the government. And I criticized that, because of course there was a conflict of interest of Francesco Giavazzi writing about Monti and being and doing work for Monti. At the same time, what happened? That Giavazzi took the job and at the same time continued to chastise Monti. And so eventually Monti got very upset, but it was wrong for him to propose the job to Giavazzi to begin with.
Good Lord. It sounds that it's, you know, deeply, deeply complicated with that situation internally within the Corriere della Sera. But let's blow this out to the huge European view. Some are saying that Italy is the next Spain, Greece. How much will political uncertainty at home worsen things for Italy on the European stage?
OK, let's give credit to Mr. Monti. Italy's reputation in the G8, in the G20, was at its lowest. And now when Mr. Obama, Mr. Hollande, Mr. Cameron and Madame Merkel met, very often the conversation is led by Mario Monti, simply because Monti knows better than anybody else how Europe works. He was commissioner for growth for many, many years, and he's a technocrat. He knows the inner machine, the nuts and bolts of Europe better than anybody else. So this enhanced Italian politics and Italian position and reputation abroad a lot. Is Italy going to be the next Greece? No, no. The reforms are going on. Italy has 1,900 billion euros of public debt, but at the same time has something between 80 and 90 100 billions of private wealth. And so this is not Greece, and Italy won't default, but we need to keep the course, and it's not easy.
Jenny Riotta, as ever, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. That was Jenny Riotta, former editor-in-chief of Il Sole and the Corriere della Sera. You're listening to Midori House. The news is next in just a moment. Taking us there, some music. This is Hug My Soul by Saint Etienne.
And that was Saint Etienne and Hug My Soul here on Monocle 24. Well, stay with us because in the next half hour on Midori House, Andrew Tuck will be looking at playful cities. He'll be talking to the mayor of Las Vegas and exploring the leisure activity of ladies in bikinis with machine guns. That's all from this section of Midori House, though. It was produced by Marcus Hippie. Our researcher was Ben Jay and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. I'm Emma Nelson. Here's the news with James Luckhurst.
Fierce gunfights between security forces and rebels have broken out on the streets of the Syrian capital, Damascus. Residents of the Medzay neighbourhood said they were hiding in their homes as gunfire outside occurred. Anti-Assad activists have uploaded photographs of gunmen in armoured vehicles rolling down the streets of the capital's Kafr Susay district, pointing long rifles over the top. In other developments, UN Special Envoy Kofi Annan told reporters at the US State Department that he would be looking for new ways of putting pressure on Damascus. UN monitors have entered the Syrian hamlet of Mazrat al-Kubair, where up to 78 people were reported killed in cold blood 2 days earlier, and an eyewitness described a scene of shredded and burnt flesh, making clear a terrible crime had occurred. President Obama says European leaders must make difficult decisions to steer the Eurozone away from crisis. Speaking at the White House, Mr. Obama said the US would support Europe in implementing the hard solutions that were needed to solve the ongoing debt crisis. He said a deep new recession in Europe would have an impact on the US economy. The UN nuclear watchdog says no progress has been made in talks with Iran on easing an investigation into the country's suspected nuclear weapons research. Hemen Naketz, global head of inspections for the International Atomic Energy Agency, said after Friday's meeting in Vienna that no date for further talks on the matter had been set. The Duke of Cambridge and Prince Harry have visited their grandfather, the Duke of Edinburgh, in hospital. Clarence Howe said the princes had paid a short private visit to Prince Philip. He was admitted to hospital in London with a bladder infection on Monday. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck. Today on our special city series, it's playtime. Cities, after all, aren't just about businesses, bus routes and building sites. They're also places to unwind. And what city is better known for its leisure activities than Las Vegas, the Sin City? Monocle correspondent Alistair G tests out Machine Guns Vegas, where scantily clad women give a shooting range a certain sex appeal.
What we're creating is really taking away that combat, you know, gun store, you know, commando feel, and breaking it into an environment which is more inviting, pleasurable. Vegas, it's an attraction.
Then, our David Michon speaks to Jean DuPont, executive director of the Rockaway Waterfront Alliance, about how the New York City beachfront is having a renaissance and giving the Hamptons a run for their money. But first, it's back to Mr. G, who, before testing out a massive firearm, talks to Las Vegas Mayor Carolyn Goodman. She took office last year following her husband, Oscar Goodman, who had held the post for a dozen years. Alistair G spoke with Mayor Goodman about how she's carrying on her husband's plan of making the desert city about more than just strip shows, gambling and bachelor parties. But how do you make a real city of Casino Central?
Tell me briefly about your own involvement with the city. I mean, your family has quite a big legacy here.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I am married to a criminal attorney who practiced the criminal law for 35 years. And then after some of his clients were no longer, he decided I want to do something different. And so he said, what do you think about my running for the office of mayor? And so without further ado, he obviously won that and was reelected twice and term limited out. My family said, you have to follow Dad's initial vision and keep it going. So here I am.
And what was his initial vision?
Well, it was really to bring back a blighted city. Las Vegas have really fallen on hard times, especially the downtown area. And so we were spreading out all around the surrounding areas of the city. And there was no culture, no really high-quality medicine, and no sense of itself. And so he was working very hard. There was no professional sports team here, which we're still working on. But the downtown area was high in crime. time, and certainly an area that people did not want to come to visit. And no art district, nothing that a substantive city should have.
I've heard that the 2012 in Las Vegas is called the year of downtown. What does that mean, and what have you got planned?
Well, it's the year that all the dominoes are falling in place from the past 12 years. We started off, the very first was to gain property in the heart of the city because there was no raw acreage because we're sort of landlocked. And there was a trade of city property for city property. And we gained the property that had been owned by the Union Pacific Railroad, which was a 61-acre parcel. And the first to come in was a discount mall, and following them came a furniture mart, and then following that became pieces of a medical complex, beginning the Cleveland Clinic Lou Ruvo Brain Institute. The next piece that came about was this performing arts center that just opened in March with fine acoustics and Broadway shows and orchestral and ballet and opera and soloists coming in to perform for our community.
It seems the city has developed this rather unlikely relationship with the online shoe retailer Zappos, and they've become essential in your redevelopment plans. How did that relationship come about?
Tony Hsieh, who is the principal of Zappos, which is now owned by Amazon.com, had their location of their headquarters had been in another part of our city called Henderson, but was not a walkable area. And he is very much about a whole lifestyle of his corporation, where it's really a community of people who can live, walk, bike, play, work, and have a whole feeling of a lifestyle that encompasses the work part. But he's also very passionate about programming and IT and technology, very much about young people and their creative minds and how they come up with ideas for technology, almost to the point that I would see in the future us moving towards becoming a hub for IT, much like up in Silicon Valley. And of course, in California, they pay both corporate and personal income tax. We have neither here in Nevada. So it's a very logical move for those up in the Silicon Valley, many of whom are Tony Hsieh's friends, to come down here to Las Vegas to establish their corporation or their residence. Plus, we have Nellis Air Force Base and the Creech Air Force Base that is highly involved in technical work and IT.
What exactly are Tony Hsieh's plans for downtown? He has this thing called the Downtown Project.
Well, the first thing is he's purchased the old City Hall and is going to put in $40 million in there to renovate it for his company. He is also committed to putting in $350 million more to be helpful in new business startup. I mean, as he goes about it, I see him ultimately having a campus, building a full-out campus of a lifestyle with parks and schools and creating a city within a city, but one that's very, very resident-friendly and where people can bike back and forth to work, don't need cars, don't need all the pollution, places where they can sit and have a cup of coffee or have a drink in the evening, all of our little taverns on Fremont East.
You were speaking before about how you'd like Las Vegas to be a sort of desert Silicon Valley. How do you plan to bring the amenities and facilities that, you know, those kinds of creative people and entrepreneurs expect and that they get in cities like San Francisco? What do you need to bring for them?
Well, when you look at San Francisco, you know, you're looking at many, many years of development, and the culture is so significant. We have never had a cultural base before, and that's what's been coming into existence now over the past, I'm going to say, 15 years. It's just coming alive with it. And for people, I mean, when you go around the world and you go to Paris, you go to Rome, you go to New York, I mean, these are older cities that, of course, have got every cultural amenity you can imagine. We had nothing. We were just a tourist hotel place. And so these are things for the residents who call this home. This is what we want here, so we can enjoy our community and see the same things and have the advantage of the joy of the great shows and concerts and ballets to come in here, and yet also our own galleries. We have tremendously creative people here. We're getting there, but we're not a couple of hundred years old yet.
With such a transient population on the Strip, a transient tourist population, with a developing but not yet fully developed strong downtown core, What are the ways that you're hoping to build a sense of community in Las Vegas?
Well, I think I mentioned that with what Tony Hsieh is doing, but we're all doing that too. My husband and I and family have lived in the same house 3 minutes away from the core of downtown, 3 minutes away for 36 years. We've seen the change. It is a place that we love, and I think it's developing. There are 39 million, 40 million people, tourists and visitors that come in here every year. They're going to want to come downtown, but those of us who have chosen to live in these high rises or in the immediate surrounding areas. I mean, we already have a nice residential population. And so all we're going to be doing is continuing to build on the infrastructure that's already in place and make it bigger and better, and just so that we can have everything, the medical care, everything that we want right here at our own fingertips.
For 22 months at the height of the financial crisis, Las Vegas had the highest foreclosure rate among U.S. cities. What's been the effect on the city with all these empty homes, and can the city do anything about it?
Well, we've been working with the banks, the local banks, and they are trying to help, and we've had several programs working with them to keep people in their homes, either reducing their payment plans or extending their mortgages. But what has resulted that's a positive sign to it, we have businesses and residences that are back at a price very affordable and probably back as to where they were in the early 1970s. And so it's coming around, and ultimately we will. It's the big lenders that we're having some difficulty with, and soon I hope they will step to the plate. But we know here in Las Vegas, this lies on us to make it work, and we're doing things. We are absolutely energized and enthusiastic about trying to help and make different groups step to the plate and help.
What do you see as the future economic bases of Las Vegas? You mentioned technology, there's gambling, that's a base right now. What do you want to bring to the city?
Well, I'm forever trying to get the TV and film industry to move in here because the weather's perfect. It's close to Los Angeles, where so much of it takes place. The cost of moving equipment back and forth, we have a wonderfully talented group of people, writers and actors and actresses, and to me that is a natural to come next. And anything else that we can come in, the small businesses right now, we used to be a place of very large developments. And that was a key to how we were so successful. We were building these hundreds of homes in these big parcels. And that's where we're hurt because of the foreclosures and everything else. But it also has freed up these smaller homes and people able to buy and get in at a nice price in a small business. So we're looking at the development of the small business arena as really key to our future success in the imminent future.
That was Alistair G talking to Las Vegas Mayor Carolyn Goodman. Next, we cross over to the East Coast, to New York City.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Every Saturday at midday in London, join our editors on Monocle 24 for The Review. We take you on a tour of three bookshops in three cities to hear what's flying off the shelves. We listen to some top tracks with a music aficionado from a different region. And we review a stack of our favourite new magazines each week too. That's The Review, the perfect way to start your weekend, here on Monocle 24.
In the first half of the 20th century, the New York City's Rockaways were a fashionable seaside retreat on the west coast of Long Island. After the Second World War, however, sections of the small Queens Peninsula were home to some of New York's worst slums. As New York's population began to boom, the largely underdeveloped Rockaways became a prime location for public housing centres for the poor and elderly. Despite its troubles, the Rockaways have once again entered the spotlight as a new wave of entrepreneurs are rediscovering what attracted beachgoers over a century ago. To learn more about the rebirth of New York City's long-lost beaches, Monocle's David Michon caught up with Jean DuPont, Executive Director of the Rockaway Waterfront Alliance.
Jean, you are the Executive Director of the Rockaway Waterfront Alliance. And I was wondering if you could start off maybe by just describing the work of the Alliance and kind of what your mission statement is.
Essentially, the mission of the Rockaway Waterfront Alliance is really to just raise awareness of the environment and the outdoor resources of the Rockaway Peninsula. And a lot of the work that we do is specifically done through programming, both with the community and also with a lot of youth. And I would say that, you know, as a result of our work, we've not only established a number of parks and public spaces, but also revitalized a lot of underutilized or neglected vacant lots. So there's a lot of great resources in the Rockaways, specifically for outdoor recreation. And so now things are really just starting to take off as people are recognizing the area for that purpose.
The Rockaway area was, you know, previously thought of as the ideal retreat from the oppressive summer heat and congestion of Manhattan and Brooklyn. At what point did the Rockaways begin to lose their kind of status as a fashionable summer destination?
Yeah, well, it's interesting how it happened. It essentially started that it was a summertime resort. People really were venturing to get out there both by train or by horse and carriage. And then as transportation started to develop, it was actually in the 1940s that Robert Moses actually helped to connect the Rockaways both through bridges and also through the subway system. So the subway system was initiated in 1941, and it was really at that point that things started to take a very different turn, because then people started to really live there year-round. It no longer became a summer resort, so it changed the way that that land was being used and the way that the community was viewed. It suddenly became a year-round resort. Also in 1915, Rockaway became part of New York City, so it was incorporated into the fifth borough of New York City, or Queens, and prior to that it was part of Long Island. So again, it was just, I think, the viewpoint of how the Rockaways were perceived changed with that, and then also as a result, a lot of issues with planning and design and all of that really put Rockaway at the back burner, because instead of decisions being made in the Rockaways, suddenly you had to go to City Hall, downtown Manhattan, to really resolve any issues that are happening out there. And it's such a long distance. It is out of sight, out of mind. So for a lot of people, that really hasn't helped the area, both politically and also economically.
Now, you mentioned that the Rockaways have kind of been neglected by New York City, you know, especially with a lot of investment kind of heading towards other challenged boroughs like Brooklyn and Queens. Is there an effort by kind of the local government or the local residents to improve the quality of life there?
There's definitely been an effort for a long, long time. The problem has been, I think, that we've never taken front and center in terms of being a priority for New York City. But it's ironic that we just actually completed city planning actually completed something called Vision 2020, which was a comprehensive waterfront plan. And I really thought as a result of that, the Rockaway would have really gotten a lot of attention and really more focus. But the Bloomberg administration, as much as they have been really focused on trying to do good and trying to do more to revitalize communities for with economic development, even within that plan, there are very few priorities that are being made that are really having a huge impact on the quality of life in Rockaway, nearly as much as Brooklyn or the Bronx. So I think, again, it hasn't been in the city's mind, and in many ways it's taken a back seat to a lot of other areas. I think there's been a lot of focus, especially on economic development and construction, for Coney Island to be kind of the main, you know, tourism district, specifically on the water. And in some ways, though, I think it's actually beneficial for Rockaway, because for, I'd say, the past 10 years, we've really hit kind of a low where, you know, crime was very high and there were a lot of foreclosures in the housing industry. And now, as a result of some of that kind of halting of development, it's actually allowed people to kind of wake up and realize that Rockaway really is the last frontier. So we have more public space, lots of vacant lots, lots of open stretches of waterfront that really have not been well utilized, And now people are starting to recognize that they don't need to build a skyscraper to be able to come out and enjoy the Rockaways. It's actually one of the benefits of that area, and I would hope would be a new found interest by the City of New York to invest in ecotourist opportunities in the Rockaways, not through building, but actually just through as what I refer to as soft infrastructure, which is just essentially programming.
And so in competing for the leisure time of New Yorkers, what's the advantage of the Rockaways over something like the Hamptons or Coney Island?
Free. The Rockaways are probably the last public and free beach in the United States. And when I say that, I really mean that, because in many ways, trying to find a beach that you can drive your car on or set foot on without paying a $20 fee is unheard of, really. You know, the houses are being built directly onto beaches all around the country where people are coveting that public space. But the Rockaways really do have, you know, 11 miles of open public beaches. It's accessible by the subway. So to pay your $250 and be on a beach in 45 minutes, that is the perk. So for people who want to go to the Hamptons and want to spend a tremendous amount of money not only getting there but staying there, that's a very different kind of thing. And I would say that just because of the convenience of getting there that quickly has really had a huge turnaround of people who normally do have the money and do have the ability to live in Hamptons, who have now kind of turned their attention more to the Rockaways for that very fact, that they do not have to be that far away from the city to be able to get to a place where they can relax and enjoy themselves.
And finally, you know, we do see a renaissance in the Rockaways. You know, there's a redevelopment of and new interest in this concept of the beach bungalow that was, you know, popular decades ago, and also, you know, a new wave of entrepreneurship that's hitting the Rockaways, new restaurants and cafes, some of which, you know, started in Manhattan or Brooklyn and have decided to open up in the Rockaways. What's changed there?
Kind of a grittier culture. I think people have decided they want to be a little bit off the beaten path. You know, even some of the celebrities who've moved there, they don't want to be, you know, hounded by press and hounded by others. So I think there's definitely a movement of artists and entrepreneurs and musicians and filmmakers who have all been making their way there purely by choice. And I think they prefer being on a beach that is, you know, not crowded, and a beach that is kind of maybe the undiscovered part of New York City. So that's what's happening, is that when I say it's the last frontier, it truly is, because everything else has been gentrified in New York, and it's very hard to find something that has been undiscovered in New York City. So this is the last part of New York still to find large parcels of land that have been virtually uncovered and undiscovered for the past 50 years.
That was Monocle's David Michon speaking to Jean DuPont. Now, before we head off, it's back to Vegas again, where Alistair G heads to Machine Guns Vegas, a shooting range that decided that the pastime needed a glamorous edge. So it's lovely young ladies who help you choose your firearm, rather than the standard butch male gun enthusiast. Alice starts by asking Leanne Heck whether or not selling guns as a sexy play activity is maybe pushing it a bit too far.
I'm Leanne Heck, and I'm a director of Machine Guns Vegas. So this is our main lobby. Customers will come through the door where they're greeted by a girl that has an iPad with all the packages.
They're very sexy girls.
Absolutely.
They're wearing not very much.
Lara Croft, eat your heart out. So they come on in and they go over to a table where everything's on an iPad. They go through all the packages and then they find the packages that actually suits the shooter. So if they're non-shooters, if they've never shot before, they'll put the packages that's good for them. At that point, they get given a pager. And they just kind of get to hang out and wait until their ammunition is ready, where they get called up to ammunition window. And at that point, they sign a waiver that says they're not crazy, drunk, or pregnant. And then they go onto the range, and then they shoot.
What do you think this place brings to Las Vegas? I mean, how does it benefit Las Vegas?
The owners of this place about a year and a half ago went to another gun range with a celebrity client that wanted to come and experience some firearms. They went to one of our competitors and walked away with such a bad taste in their mouth that they decided that Vegas needed something more high-end for that experience, which is why we were created. So what we're creating is really taking away that combat, you know, gun store, you know, commando feel, and breaking it into an environment which is more inviting, pleasurable. Vegas, it's an attraction.
So it's like a glam gun school, basically. A glam firing range. Is there something about Las Vegas as well? Like, it's very permissive here. There's the idea that you can do anything here. Is that part of the reasoning as well?
Absolutely. It's Sin City. It's a novelty of something to do. We get about 18% of our clients are from the UK, which is a big percentage considering it's so far away. Yeah, they can do it there. They want to experience it in a controlled environment. That's exactly what we give them.
Do you get mostly men or mostly women coming here?
About 30% of our clientele are actually first-time shooters for females that want to experience something. And they don't feel intimidated coming to us because we have female range officers that, you know, are going to stand next to them and actually show them from their point of view how to do things. So yeah, 30% of our clientele is definitely female.
So tell me, how did you get into firing guns?
I came here 13 years ago, and my sister actually married into a family that owned gun ranges. And so the first time I actually went to fire, I was 18 years old, fresh from the UK, went to a firing range, nothing like this, and was given a handgun. And they took me out to the range and showed me how to use a handgun. That was the first time I ever fired one. Went, you know, shot a few things out in the desert here and there years after that. And in 2009, I went over to one of our competitors, actually, and worked for them for 2 years and shot everything, 60 firearms. So it just becomes, it's one of those things, it's an adrenaline rush. You know, it's knowing that you can't, where you're born and raised, you can't do this. Now I'm in a country where I can do it every day if I want to. I don't, but I can.
Why do you think people like to fire guns?
It's a novelty. It's an adrenaline rush. Feeling, you know, that firearm go off, feeling, you know, having control of something that could possibly, you know, injure somebody or having a bang, it's powerful.
Is it a sense of power?
Absolutely. Yeah, nobody really messes you when they know you're carrying a gun. I mean, absolutely.
Being here makes me think about gun control in the States. I mean, famously, the laws in Europe are a lot stricter than they are here in America. What do you think about that? Do you think that the very liberal laws, do they lead to things like school shootings?
No, absolutely. Knowledge of a firearm and how it works and gun control. I mean, there is gun controls in America. There is very strong gun controls. You have to... so many background checks you actually have to get to have one of these firearms that probably the average Joe wouldn't be able to pass. There's always going to be criminals that gets things on the black market, whether it be here, whether it be the UK. Best line that everybody likes to use around here is guns kill people like spoons make people fat. You know, it's definitely, it's the operator. You know, if more people knew the knowledge behind a firearm and how to operate, there'd be less fatalities, without a doubt.
I guess one question that occurs to me is, do you think it's okay to glamorize something that could potentially kill someone and that was designed to kill someone?
Absolutely. We do not glamorize guns in any way here. It's very strict at all times. Our safety officers are in control of that firearm from the minute that you walk onto this range to the minute you leave. Everybody's sidearmed. It is definitely designed to make sure that you're safe in here. When you leave here, it's probably more unsafe on the streets than you are in this building right here.
It is made into a sexy thing here, right? Like when we walked in, there were these girls in sort of skimpy outfits. It's glamorizing a little bit, wouldn't you
Absolutely.
Say?
Absolutely, but you ask any one of those girls any technical question, they're going to have the answer that you don't. So they know their product.
All right, well, do I get to fire a gun now?
Absolutely. I'm going to leave you in his hands where I handle this. I'll see you in a second.
Perfect.
Okay, right-handed or left-handed?
Right-handed.
All right.
What is this? This is an enormous gun.
No, it's our medium one. It's the MP5. It's a semi-automatic, as long as it's fully automatic. First thing we'll hold it. Nice firm grip on the pistol grip. Finger straight forward off the trigger until you're ready to engage your target. Nice and tight in your shoulder. Pull it tight with your right hand. Left hand right here on the bottom stock. Also pull it tight into your hand.
Okay.
Multiple bursts.
I'm going to confess that I'm a little bit frightened of this weapon I'm about to hold.
Well, what I'll do is I'll start you off on semi, which will give you one pull, one round. And then what I'll do, maybe after three rounds, I'll flip it to full, and then you'll experience 5 to 6 rounds per pull.
Okay, let's do this. Wow, that's such a smell of cordite. Yeah. That hit me in the head.
That was a rather frightened Alistair G at Machine Guns Vegas. That's all for this final episode of the Midori House City Series. To see you out, a song. Here's the B-52s with The Queen of Las Vegas.